Welcome to the Minute of Eight Gang Podcast, episode 226. I'm Steve Borsch, and I'm on with Tim Elliott.
Good morning.
Graham Thickens.
Greetings from the Lake Country.
His mobile portable studio, his car. And Phil Wilson.
Good morning.
How you guys doing this morning?
Great.
Yeah, I was telling somebody last night about the, or yesterday, I went to that startup school that I was telling somebody about Graham's little secret studio. Yeah. How he pulls up next to the outside the, is it outside a cafe?
No, it's right upside the cabin.
Oh, outside your cabin.
Because they're close to the router.
To the router. I love that. Yeah.
With the lake view.
So, Phil, how did you do on the pop quiz?
Well, you know, the startup school is an interesting idea. I mean, the reason I went is I really respect a lot of the people that were there. You know, George Reese spoke and Matt Dornquist spoke. And, and all those guys, I really enjoyed listening to them. I tell you, it was a full day event, but by about 1 o'clock, you're saying, okay, I've heard enough stories about startups. But at the same time, there are little pearls of wisdom from every single one of them. Most of them are very obviously very successful startups like Code42 and Stratasys and that sort of thing. So, but it was good. They held it at the Brave New Workshop last night or yesterday, all day.
On Hennepin?
On Hennepin.
Yeah.
How many people showed up? A lot?
There's probably 80.
Wow. Yeah, that's a good show. I mean,
and that was a full house at the theater that they ran. I don't know. I just think it was, I think they put it together nicely, but it wasn't very interactive. It was very much a presentation, you know? So yeah. I don't know necessarily if you could consider it a school. There were a lot of the history of my startup. Here's the one thing that I liked the best was Justin Koffenberg's sort of history. He took a slide deck from TST Media, one of their first slide decks when they were out looking for funding. And this was years ago, or I guess 2011. And what he did is he brought that slide deck and he reviewed the slides looking back on it now and what he would have done differently and that sort of a thing. So that was a very, very interesting discussion. Yeah. All of them were interesting, but that was probably the most teaching that was going on.
Yeah. Justin's great. I've worked with some of these guys and they amaze me how they're so willing to help other startups and take time, but it can be difficult to get on their schedules. I mean, they're pretty busy guys. So bringing them together in one place like that is great. And, you know, whether it was interactive or not, I'm sure the startup hopefuls in the audience were hanging on their every word, you know, because they all have great stories. And, you know, if you listen to them, they've got great pointers at every turn, you know. So, yeah, it sounds like a great event. And to get them to take out time like that is good. But I think it's easier for them to do it in one place like that than to try to meet individually with so many startups one-on-one, you know.
Was there anybody there like there's a Twin City startup that Catherine Grayson wrote about that got Google support? You know, Kurt Roots, right? He's written from Innovate. And his wife. Did you see him there by any chance?
No, I'm sorry. I did not. I did not, but I am interested in talking a little bit about that start. Before we leave that topic, though, I just wanted to highlight a couple of different things. Doug Berg, who was of Jobs to Web,
that got acquired by SuccessFactors, which got acquired by SAP.
Yeah, he was he's a very energetic speaker, very enthusiastic. I think the biggest takeaway I got from him was, know when to sell, try not to be too greedy. If your exit strategy is to sell the company, maybe look at those earlier offers rather than you talked about, one of the iterations of Jobs to Web, how it, in 2000, just before, the crash. They got a really great offer and held off, and then the crash happened. And then they really weren't able to unload it at that point in time. Matthew Dornquist, his biggest takeaway, I think one thing he emphasized the most, is how many co-founders to have. He's a big believer in you need three co-founders for your startup.
Really? So you need like an engineering guy, right?
Yeah, it's basically, if you
financial guy.
Yeah, if you're putting together a startup, it's a lot of work. He said it's ongoing, it's continuous. A, you need to take a break, and if you take a break, then everything stops. If you're a solo, if you get hit by a bus, everything stops. He's a big believer in having three people. Now, beyond the concept of voting, you've got three people voting, so you've always got a decisive vote. But he just really believes in that. And somebody said, well, what advice do you have for a single person startup? He said, find two more co-founders.
So, interesting. Well, that really lends credence then to the article that I wrote about Co-Founders Lab to expand in Minnesota. And that's exactly what that's all about, is finding additional co-founders.
Mm-hmm. Huh. So yeah, it's critical. It really is. And there is magic in three, I mean, two's okay, but three is much better.
Yeah, he was just adamant about that. I mean, very respectful, very thoughtful way. I mean, he wasn't, by any means. Anybody that's ever met Matthew Dornquist knows he's not, by no means has any sort of prick tendencies, so he doesn't come across as being arrogant or anything like that. So it's like, it was something that was very important to him. And, he comes down to, being very logical about not killing yourself doing this. You still have to have a life. You still have to have a family and that sort of a thing. And George Reese also did that. Yeah. He came back around and saying that, there are these priorities in your life.
George, starting up. George has not come across as funny as he really is.
I know.
He is really, I follow him on Twitter, and he is in Stratius, and he's just a really funny guy. I mean,
he still pronounces it in Stratus. So.
Oh, he does. Okay.
Yeah, it's much better that way.
How about in it's Stratius? No,
in Stratius. No. There you go.
All right.
Well, listen. I did want to highlight that. You talked about that startup, Steve. That's got a little bit of Google funding.
Yeah.
For the game for ADHD and diagnosis of ADHD and perhaps autism, and talk a little more about that, because that's pretty exciting stuff. And my wife has worked with autistic kids for the school system here in the past, and that sort of stuff always very interesting to me.
Well, it's what I find interesting is A, how they basically took all of their background, his background in technology, and he's a very accomplished guy, and I won't go into all the background, but his wife is a psychiatrist. So she's an MD and focused on psychiatry in child and adolescence. And so they started this startup called CogCubed, and it's all about, actual tactile stuff that you can use to help diagnose different childhood mental maladies. And, it's really fascinating.
Yeah, the cube thing is interesting. Had you, Tim, are you familiar with those cubes at all?
No. It says it's developed at MIT. So apparently this is something that psychiatrists or other people that are in this field use. So what's interesting is they've turned it into like a video game. So, mm-hmm. I think that this would be pretty interesting to the kids that they're actually trying to use on it.
Well, I'll put a link in the show notes to those cubes. They're called Siftio cubes, and it's really about interactive gaming. And
is
so
that
it's a platform.
Same sort of, is that the same sort of cube that the new Scrabble game is using? Is that the same sort of a deal?
I don't know that.
There's a new Scrabble game that's sort of like uses a cube sort of system, and I was kind of curious. I didn't have a chance to dig into that too much.
Okay.
There's a longer piece in the strip that I put in the notes too that you might want to stick on the show notes that gives a little more background on that, all this.
Yeah, they got $20,000 from Google, mm-hmm. apparently. I wonder how they did that or through what program that was. Maybe the article goes into that.
Google drops 20 grand on the floor of their car on a regular basis.
That's just the diet cream soda in the refrigerator.
No kidding. Right. Well, I wonder if it was through that Google for Entrepreneurs program.
I would imagine it was that
Coco cooked up. Yeah, because I see this duo locates themselves at Coco because the photo in one of the stories was shot there. Mm-hmm. So good for them.
Yeah, and on the game front, and Coco and tie-ins with, you know, co-working and that sort of thing. The guys at Choosatron went on to Kickstarter,
and surpassed their goal.
They've already surpassed their goal.
Choosatron
was at Mini Demo. I didn't get a chance to see that demo. Dang, you know, but that was that's an interesting thing. And they're now tied to SparkCore. SparkCore is doing.
Oh, you're kidding.
So, yeah, that's what they use.
Yeah.
Oh, geez, I didn't even see that. I didn't even notice that.
It's built on top of Spark, yeah.
Well, so here's what's the cool thing, and I stole this idea to get my kids to do stuff that, to go hunt for things and so on, is I put together a treasure map, and they were, you know, like 5 and 10 years old five and eight at the time, put together a treasure map, and they had to literally be detectives and go out and find all the clues and put them together and so on. And kids, I mean, to talk about engaging. And so that's what I saw when I looked at this Choosatron, is I thought kids are going to totally goof on this.
Well, this took me back to like Zork and Infidel all the other kinds of interactive text games.
Yeah.
That were out, you know, in the Apple II era and the Commodore 64. So it's the same idea, but it prints it out on little printed, roll of paper.
Yeah. which I think is very cool. I think.
Yeah, that idea makes it better. I think that it's an experience that you can like carry back and you can share with your friends and all this. Sort of the genius of the whole thing.
Well, I remember when we were at, this was a couple of years ago, and my daughter plays, traveling basketball, and we were in Rochester for a traveling basketball tournament. We had time in between games, and a bunch of the parents and the girls went to the mall, and we were all sitting around the food court trying to figure out what to do to kill 2 or 3 hours of time or whatever it was. And basically I whipped out and did a quick little scavenger hunt thing, put together. It's just amazing how much that lights kids up. It's something that's all of a sudden, you know, it's not something that you do on your phone. It's not something you do in front of a screen. It's like, oh, you get out and actually do stuff. So.
Well, that's what I love about geocaching, where you can use your phone and go out and use GPS coordinates or a GPS device to go.
Do you do a lot of geocaching up there at the lake, Graham?
Oh, all the time.
Sarcasm. That was sarcasm.
Oh my gosh, I got enough things to do up here without geocaching.
Well, why not? Okay. All right.
One thing we do need to talk about is that we heard from a friend of ours, one of our video gurus, Brian Stemmler, a couple of weeks ago. He had some interesting stuff to talk about. We reached out to see if Brian wanted to join us on the podcast to talk about branded television channels or branded video channels. And so we're going to have him come up here in a minute. Do you want to pause and do that now, guys?
Yeah, I think we should, but I want to set something up for just 2 seconds with Brian. And it was so funny because he just did a commercial and he was actually one of the actors, and I did not know that he was an Emmy award-winning actor.
What's up with that?
I know, we got to find out what's going on there.
Soap operas or what is it?
Commercials. I don't know. Yeah. Commercials. I think it's all commercials. Yeah. Yeah.
Unless he was in some sort of torrid soap opera.
Yeah. And now he's on Twin Cities Live at KSTP. He's working as a commercial producer and a producer on that show. But what's interesting is his discussions was he had gotten back from this seminar in New York and talking about the next generation of video content business models. And here's why this is so important right now, is because all of the direction relative to content strategy And you got people like Lee Oden, you know, who's written a book locally here on content strategy called Optimize. And it is what everybody's talking about with respect to content curation and everything else. And video is so key to that. So yeah, let's do that. Let's bring Brian on, because he is, you know, he's also done a ton of stuff with respect to just helping out local events, right? Like social media breakfast. He's done streaming video and
we did a bunch of work for MEMA not too long ago as well.
Okay,
so, but I don't think he won the Emmy for that.
No, we'll have to find out. Brian, are you on?
Hey guys.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How do I sound?
Well, definitely. This would not make the cut on any of your productions.
Well, he's a video guy, not an audio guy.
He's not
Come
an
on,
audio guy. Yeah, right.
Exactly. Right. Right. No, I tried to have like a fancy setup. And you know, technology, it's at the moment you need it, it typically deceives you.
Brian, before we get started, I know this is not by any means important to the topic. What'd you win the Emmy for in acting? I mean, was it the car commercial we've seen you in?
No. This was, I got my start at an early age of 10 years old in St. Louis and doing commercials in the local market. And I starred in a TV show that they aired during kind of the, I think it was like the after school special hour. And it was a half hour special where it was about this boy that would have these daydreams. And every time they would go to the daydreams, it would turn into an animation. So I was actually animated. They had me as an animated character. And I went up against one of the top anchors for best performer or host back in 1983, I think.
Wow.
And I beat her. And I feel worse for her than I do feel good for myself, because being beat out by a 10-year-old is probably pretty hard to take.
Well, I think it kind of, you know, it tends to happen. So
yeah,
I think she got over. She didn't kill herself.
So yeah, and it's pretty much been all downhill from then.
Well, talk about, you had reached out to us. Talk a little bit about this branded video concept that we're. You know, obviously has become more and more important. So
yeah,
we'd love to, you know, give us your quick overview of that.
Well, I've been paying attention to this area for quite some time now, and have been frustrated seeing that hasn't been adopted more quickly than I had hoped. But it's exciting to see that it finally is. And that's why I went to this conference, because, you know, the title of the conference was, online video, how we will monetize. And it was finally like, okay, so now the real money is going to start flowing in. Because I think that's been the biggest challenge with online media, is that, you know, companies have been just like spending and putting, you know, fairly small budgets towards it because they've been afraid of too much risk. You know, my understanding, that's, you know, with regards to branded content, you know, they're kind of redefining video all the time and trying to parse it out. So a lot of times nowadays, just kind of getting on the same page with whoever you're talking about when it comes to video content is part of the challenge. So, you know, which is a good example. Like when you guys think of branded content, what do you think about? With what you're seeing?
Well, it's branded content is really all about not just, you know, me, you know, our company, our product, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's all about, you know, maybe putting a context together. So if they're in a category, they need to educate or raise the horizons of their potential prospective audience or consumer. It's all about delivering content, you know, where people need it and at the right time and all of that. Because you had put something in about Nine West and their their Channel 9, and we'll put a link in the show notes for everyone.
Yeah,
but that's a great example. But it's not. I think when a lot of companies look at what they're going to deliver, you know, they don't think about branded content, you know, being a separate sort of thing, but rather, you know, just augmenting what they're already doing. So right. rather than here's a picture of our product, oh, by the way, here's a video.
Mm-hmm.
So you can deep dive. But I was actually looking at what you were talking about as sort of an extension when you talked about video content business models, talking about it as an extension of content strategy or content mm-hmm. marketing. You know, Lee Oden here in town has done his whole thing on with his book Optimize on content marketing. And everybody wants to tell a better story. Everybody wants to raise horizons. Everybody wants to create something that will be shareable and that people want to share, not that it's some boring thing.
Yeah.
So does that kind of fit with what you think too?
Yeah. And really, depending on whatever brand you are, it's important to know kind of what you are not as much as what you are. Because of course, if you're not really a lifestyle company, then it's going to be more challenging to produce this type of content than if it fits into easily to more of like a fashion, you know, food fashion or entertainment type of category. And so I think you're right. I mean, I think that, and that's for advertisers, you know, the sense that I get is it's been kind of painful for them to break out of the ad model of selling. And that's the slippery slope with content marketing, is that it has to pass the smell test
right.
with the audience. I do think that audiences, especially the millennials, are becoming much more tolerant of it. It's kind of like, I know that you're selling me. Just don't be too obvious and don't be too pushy about it, you know, provide me the value that I'm looking for and you can sell me, that's fine. And I think for my interest, you know, I'm not a marketer and I'm not really interested in figuring out all the different products that there are and how to develop those. My interest more is as a news magazine producer of kind of lifestyle content for television. You know, that's kind of what's funny is that you see a lot of TV and TV production companies now moving into this arena who are now producing content that they're now then going to the brands and saying, hey, do you want to sponsor this content? Or do you want, you know, well, we'll sell ads against it. So for my part, moving from Los Angeles to Minneapolis, there's not tons of TV content being produced here or that kind of stuff. But I've seen the trend and I really believe it's starting to hit a crest where I believe brands can create their own type of, because I'm sure that they're spending some of their money on sponsoring outside content that's being like third party content that's being produced for them. But I think that they can also be doing a lot of this in-house.
Graham here, Brian. I there's a definite trend towards companies practicing what's called brand journalism. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of this is written content as opposed to video. But there are many good examples of, you know, mostly consumer companies. But there's actually some good B2B examples as well. Intel being one that's heavy into it, where they're hiring experienced content people, mm-hmm. you know, writers, editors, and, you know, videographers as well. And, you know, launching these sites that provide helpful content and support their brand without shoving their product messages down your throat, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there really are many, many examples. I was just reading one recently. Red Bull is obviously a huge, a practitioner of this. And you know, what I've written in the past is that, you know, there's great hope here for journalists from traditional media where the jobs have been declining rapidly. And many of the smart ones are moving over to you know, brand journalism. You know, many of the, you know, purist journalism kind of folks, you know, just maybe still turn their nose up at that. But you know, it's just a different employer. And you're still telling stories and you're writing about interesting stuff that your readers want to know about. And a lot of it's entertainment oriented. And has nothing specifically to do with the brand at all, right. You know, with the, certainly with the products, but there's a big movement in this area, and I follow a lot of the people who write about it. There's a LinkedIn group. There've been books written about this topic, and it, you know, it dovetails into content marketing. You know, it's maybe just a different term for it, if you will, but it's there's a lot going on in the space, and local companies as well that are working on consumer information kind of sites that support their brand as a you know, as being a brand that wants to help people and educate them and just help them understand the issues surrounding, you know, healthcare or whatever. You know, there's a lot going on. We're going to be hearing more and more about these kinds of channels, if you will.
Well, Brian, quick question for you. So one of the things that I know that I personally hate is when you go to a site and you want to look at their tour or something and you push the play button on the video and it's like, this is Susie. She wants to talk to Jack. Jack is over in London, you know, and it's one of those kind, and you're like, oh, please, seriously, just give me your value prop without all the, you know, scenario with little cartoon characters.
Yeah.
And what I look at is from a content strategy perspective, is videos that augment, you know, learning about a product so you can have, you know, here's the product and here's the 40,000 foot view. Now, if you want to drill in, you want to look at tech specs, you want to look at, you know, really the ins and outs, if you want to download manuals, and if you just want to see a video about it, it's all there at your fingertips. What I haven't seen, and I'm wondering what you think about how this fits in, but Vimeo Pro, which is, I think, $59 a year or $99, I can't remember what I pay.
Yeah.
At the end of the video, you can have a link with some text. Right. And so you can have a call to action at the end of the video. Click here to learn more. Click here to buy. Click here to see our page on this product or this category. And so do you have a lot of clients that are actually using video in that way where there's a call to action at the end or kind of what's your vision around how you would go and approach a client with how they should best leverage video?
Right. Well, I think, and this is where it starts getting slippery, because when it comes to video, there are different facets. So, and one thing that has been, I think that's what has, one reason why content marketing hasn't really taken off until now is because firstly, they had to figure out the delivery platforms and get those rock solid so that they didn't fail. And then they had to figure out how to work the advertising models, which I think are beginning to really yield, you know, and get there. With regards to that, there are, you know, of course, everybody's been jumping on YouTube and using YouTube primarily because their interface is just really good. And that you can, you know, you can add what do you call it? Like hotspots on the video,
right.
And where people can make it clickable. And a lot of people do that. I think that there have been people that dabbled in that. But then I think integrating it with like maybe their shopping app, and other things, it's been kind of a hit and miss. I've not heard any real success stories with that yet, although I think that that's coming, especially with integrated TVs, you know, where you'll be watching something and you'll be able to like click on something and then go and buy that blouse that whoever's wearing. But I think for my, you know, so I was looking and you know, they're, I think another thing that you're going to start seeing is brands, they'll be having a YouTube presence. I think YouTube is not going away, but they're going to, there are a lot of these proprietary delivery platforms that are popping up that are providing, you know, really robust service, video delivery service, but then also ad placement, targeted ad placement, so that your clients aren't getting inundated with ads that aren't applicable to them. So that's another area that I think is going to be interesting to watch is the delivery platforms, and some to keep an eye out for. There's and these are delivery platforms, kind of like Vimeo. So, but these are more towards the proprietary and big brands. So one is Videology, and another one is LiveRail.
Yep, I know Videology. I don't know LiveRail. Yeah.
Share Through and Adapt TV. And so, and that's another area that I'm probably not going to get too wrapped up in with my clients, because I feel like there are probably a lot of other people out there who understand that, you know, likewise with the ad models, which I think they're calling programmatic now. That's like the new term they're calling, which is basically how to figure out, and it's all algorithmic, you know, basically being like, we're going to create an ad and we're going to place it against all this type of content based on the metadata that it is. And that's more of probably the marketing arena. But I wanted to get back to, you know, with me, with regards to video, you know, there, you know, of course, that there are many different video products, and like one of the things you were talking about, Steve, what I would call more of kind of like a one-off, you know, like a video that has a call to action. And, you know, the area that I'm interested in is more of kind of like the regular creating series. So like a 13 episode series where it's like either like an interview series or some sort of a news magazine type of series that really builds an audience. It's not about having them watch it and then getting a call to action or having something happen at the end. It's about having people come back to your site over and over. And,
you know, can I just ask in terms of an actual example? So I'm looking at your YouTube page right now, and I'll put a link in the show notes, But Balanced Body Pilates, where, you know, Pilates for athletes and there's various episodes. And is that directionally what you're kind of talking about?
Well, that's one. They've done a good job. And their primary clientele are actual Pilates instructors. So a lot of times they're already preaching to the choir. But it's a value added service for their clients, because, you know, of course, Balanced Body, they make all their money selling equipment. So they're not making any money selling, or on these videos, but it's just about enhancing their brand and building up, goodwill between them and their audience. And I think that's that with regards to the kind of branded content that I am interested in. It's not the sort of thing where, you know, it's going to necessarily bring in dollars or show a lot of hits. I mean, what I've read is that and heard is that if you start focusing on this type of content in terms of amount of hits or the viral nature of it or the kind of click-throughs, that's not what it's kind of intended for.
Yeah.
I think, and it's intended to. It's more of a marathon as opposed to a sprint when it comes to marketing. And I think that social media, seeing how social media and, you know, doing the Twittering and the Pinterest and stuff, that brands and ad agencies have kind of figured this out through that, realizing that they're not going to get a hit based on one tweet. It's about just the constant flow of information. And I think that you're going to start seeing more of that happen with regards to video, that is just creating content that is a regular stream as opposed to one-offs. But in terms of examples, one, I think that General Electric actually is, I think, doing a pretty good job with creating different types of video products. And they, an example of a good example of what I'm, my kind of area of interest is they did a brilliant brunch at South by Southwest in 2013, where they brought a bunch of young innovators together for basically a lunch conference, just lunch talk. And so it's on YouTube, and you guys could, it might be a good link to it. But it's entertaining, but it's not trying to sell anything.
There's one thing that concerns me that I'd like to get your comment on, Brian, is the whole issue of disclosure with branded content.
Yeah.
There's a lot of packages that are done, you know, like for local TV news that are packaged around events like, say, CES, that are sponsored by people like Microsoft and other companies that want to highlight their products within those reports that are this kind of passed off as news.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of what is best practice in that area, and how do companies, you know, walk that line between the creative editorial side and the commerce side?
Yeah. Well, and that's what's interesting is on the TV side and on the producer side, those lines are blurring more and more, and the firewalls are kind of coming down. And because I think that, you know, our audiences are becoming much more accepting of this sort of integration. And that, I think that as a company, you know, what's kind of funny is that it seemed like investing in viral video content creation was always much more of a risk with regards to offending somebody or going overstepping the line than what I think branded content could be. Because, you know, unless you're doing something that, how do I say it? I just think that it depends on what product it is that you're making. I feel like if you're doing kind of like a lifestyle content, you know, kind of just, you know, like this South by Southwest conversational piece, you know, you're not going to run the risk of offending too many people or getting into any controversial subjects. And I think that as you see with like social media, as long as you are on top of it and you're able to kind of backtrack and apologize or make a disclaimer, that most people are accepting of that. So I think that, and that's another area with this, you can't have too many people policing it or too many people. You can't be too worried about the content that you're putting out. Otherwise it's going to start not feeling genuine. So that's the slip. That's the kind of the balance that you have to hit. And
well, should you have the old media sort of sponsored by, you know, name of company here as a disclaimer, or is it okay to pass off news stories as news, but they're really sponsored by, and the news part of it is sort of a company message?
Yeah. Well, it's going to get more and more vague. I think there might be some backlash. I mean, you know, BuzzFeed is kind of, they're the ones who are testing the waters with regards to this in terms of placing advertisements that look like editorial publications next to it. And then all it has is like this tiny little bar that says sponsored content above it. So, you know, I think that will be an interesting company to watch with regards to this. AOL and HuffPost and their various channels, they'll be another good company to watch because they are really, I mean, Huffington Post especially, I think is really kind of riding that line between editorial and sponsored advertising content. So I think we could kind of take the lead from some of these producers and see how that works, and then and see how maybe brands themselves could adopt that if in the content that they're creating. So, you know, it's the Wild West, and it's you know, not for, there's nothing for sure, but I think that what's exciting is that I think that the companies are beginning to dabble in this, and they might be able to create some interesting stuff that even, you know, even the producers, the traditional producers haven't thought of.
So what's your take on some of the new things that Google is doing? Over the past couple of weeks, they've come out with this Chromecast device, and then more recently with the Moto X, which has greater integrations with Google Now to a degree where if you're watching TV, it knows the show you're watching because it's listening, and it can give you a card for more details about, you know, the show you're watching. It'd only take a nanosecond to figure out that they're going to push ads based upon the context of what you're consuming.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you think
they're going to do that? Really?
Oh yeah, absolutely. No, they're doing it now, and that's why people were saying, "Well, why did they put the Chromecast out for $35 when they could have probably put it out for, you know, $69 and would have sold out?" They're putting it out because they want to know what you're watching, and then they have this phone that's always listening, that can listen for programs and various other things, and can then feed you information without you even doing anything, based upon the context of that interaction.
Yeah. I think that all of that interaction is ultimately, I think, going to be better for the consumer, because you're going to be getting fed content that is applicable to you. I think what's interesting though is, you know, will it end up mattering where the content's coming from, whether it's coming to you directly from a brand or coming from Hulu or from, you know, ABC or CBS or NBC. We'll see how that works. But you know, and that's what can be frustrating, is like technology is one thing, but then it's all about the people playing well together. And you're seeing like, an example is like CBS, basically Time Warner Cable. They just pulled CBS from their service.
Yeah.
You know, and so that could be another touchy situation that might end up really hurting the technology if people don't want to play well together. But I think that with regards to brands as publishers, hopefully they will move to producing content that is applicable to their brand, which, you know, increases brand awareness and maybe brand people being committed to the brand, but then also provides a value to the viewer. That's where it's like, I learned something, or this is really entertaining, and it's not just, I'm not just being sold something. So I'm hoping that happens. But I definitely know that the producers who are producing content for online and for these digital properties are really catering to brands that they want to sponsor their content. And so the lines are getting blurred with regards to that.
Well, last question I've got for you is related to all of the video show startups, you know, call them netcasts or video podcasts and so forth. There's a lot of really, really great content. And in fact, I've looked at Stemler Productions. We'll put a link in the show notes. And you just think about all the organizations.
Never heard of them. What?
Never heard of them, yeah. But all the thought leaders that have, you know, created their own shows, I haven't found a lot of episodic shows. There's some that are out there, but I don't really follow them. But do you think that corporations, that enterprise organizations or anybody that wants to create either episodic content or branded content will, you know, hire some of these companies or even acquire them?
Yeah.
And have you seen any of that happen?
Yes, I have seen Philip DeFranco is a YouTube star who basically had, I think it was a daily video podcast where he just talked directly to the camera. And I think he was one of the guys who first started this kind of that fast cut technique that you probably have seen, where it's the person's talking directly to their web camera, but it's all choppy because they like cut out all the and just to make it sound very kind of fast and staccato and witty.
Well, didn't Zay Frank really, he was really the guy that started that?
You're right. And then,
so DeFranco is just he's a ripoff of Zay Frank.
Well, yes, but this is, well, and, you know, and do you guys remember Ask a Ninja?
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
He did that too. And then those guys kind of faded away. I mean, Zay Frank is still around. And actually I think he's now, I don't know the production company, but, he's now basically kind of behind the scenes producing as kind of an executive producer of this type of stuff. But anyway, to get to it, some of these YouTube stars are now getting picked up and hired off by more enterprise companies to be advisors and to produce other shows for them. We'll see how much that happens, because honestly, you know, a lot of these YouTube stars, they're used to just working alone, and we'll see if they are able to kind of translate that into working in a more corporate environment or a bigger company.
Yeah.
But yes, that will happen. But I also think that a lot of traditional media companies, production companies, they've been watching and sitting back and figuring all this out, and they will be jumping into this fray. So I think it's kind of like, as much as things change, they stay the same. So I think you're going to see a lot of more, you know, the established production companies with good workflows getting into this arena, producing content, for brands, but then you'll also see brands doing it themselves. A couple of companies to maybe take a look at regarding creating content for companies is Starcom MediaVest and then, you know, of course, AOL Digital. They're really doing a lot in terms of, you know, producing their own content, but then also, if you are a brand, you could go to AOL and they could be a production arm for you. And as well as, I'm looking here. And Yahoo's, you know, they're creating a lot of content too. And whether or not they will produce directly for brands, I'm not sure, but they're producing a lot of content, which then, you know, they get brand sponsorship for.
Another interesting thing that came out in one of the links you provided, Brian, was that VCs are investing in some of these YouTube companies, you know, companies that are just pushing out content on YouTube. The one guy who's really strong in this, I think, is Ken Lehrer, the co-founder of Huffington Post.
Mm-hmm.
I found that link really, really interesting that you provided a good interview with him, too.
Yeah.
And talking about how content, now that distribution has been established on the internet, you know, it's moving towards content, and he firmly believes in funding, you know, content companies, you know,
right,
in several areas that he talked about in that interview. But yeah, that paid content link that you provided cited the daily pop culture live show on YouTube, What's Trending?
Yes.
Which he recently invested in through his venture fund.
Right.
Bedrocket Entertainment.
Well, do you guys remember when Discovery Communications bought Revision 3? You know, mm-hmm. Revision 3 does all kinds of great shows. My son and I watch Film Riot all the time. Yeah. When they bought them, I thought that was really interesting, mainly because I remember when Revision 3 came up and how they had radically lowered the cost of creating an amazing production studio. I mean, they did it for about $1 million. Mm-hmm. They were touting the fact that this was about a $10 million studio if they were to buy professional level this and that, and, you know, from Sony or Panasonic. And those guys, Discovery, also brought in Philip DeFranco.
Right.
And he's now working for the network. I'll see if I can find a link for the show notes. But are you,
yeah.
Yeah. Anyway,
that's what I was mentioning is Jim Lauterbeck, who's the CEO of Revision 3. He's really on the cutting edge of this stuff and finding that kind of sweet spot regarding production values and content, and doing it at a lower cost. So have you guys heard they just launched a digital network called Test Tube?
No.
Yeah, so it's testtube.com, and so it's a Discovery digital network that's run by Revision 3, and it looks like they're doing basically, they'll have probably one-offs of their TV content, but then they're also creating original programming directly for online.
Wow, yeah, I'm looking at it right now. I had no idea this even existed.
Yeah.
Huh.
So that's a good example. And then, like you were talking, Graham, about YouTube, that's, you know, they're not going away anytime soon. And the companies that live on there are investing too. It's and a couple examples are Smosh and Machinima, which is that channel that's dedicated to gamers. I mean, that, talk about money. I mean, if you want to make some money, you know, make content that is attractive to gamers.
Oh my God. My son loves, the Rooster Teeth podcast, and he listened, you know, obviously there's a bunch of offshoots from that, but yeah, that whole machinima, genre is huge.
Yeah. You know, and these are examples of companies that are producing content which then they can make money via ad sales. But say, for instance, if you were a brand creating this type of entertainment content, you wouldn't necessarily be worried about selling ads against it. It's more about just building an audience.
Yeah.
And I think that's where you start having to have a different conversation about, well, what's the motivation for this? And I'm sure that, you know, Test Tube will probably be adding on sponsors. So brands will probably have different pots that they pull from. So we're going to spend some money on sponsoring outside content, third-party content, but then maybe we'll allocate a little bit of our money to producing some in-house stuff. I don't know. We'll see. I get a sense, and I think you probably see more of some local ad agencies who are churning out this stuff, this kind of content for their clients.
Yeah. I think maybe our friends at Fallon are doing that. You mentioned Star MediaVest. That's part of one of the big ad holding companies, might be the same one that Fallon's part of, Publicis.
Oh yeah.
I think it's part of that one, but the agencies are definitely all over this.
Yeah.
Well, obviously it's a huge space. There's a lot of growth available to it. And Brian, thanks very much for drawing our attention to it and for being on the podcast to just share it with us. Thanks very much, man.
Well, this is awesome. I'm so glad to be a part of it.
Well, and, you know, good luck on your next Emmy win.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I did just star in another commercial that we produced at KSDP. It's for AAA Insurance. And I play Agent AAA. And I think you'll be seeing it on air soon. And I think it's going to be fun. So
there you go.
So, yeah, I'm pulling out all the stops. I'm, you know, producer. I can do camera editing, and I can also be in front of the camera.
What a guy.
Well, just think, if you can dress up in drag and you can play two parts and do your own web series. All right, man.
Not out of the question.
Yeah. Thanks Brian.
All right, guys.
Thanks, Brian.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Oh, how fun.
It's always good to talk to Brian.
Yeah, I'd love to have his skills. I mean, look at his background in video production. It's just, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing.
He's got a lot going on.
Yeah. Well, we're kissing the hour, boys, but we got a couple more things that I know that I think you, Graham, you really want to talk about Moto X.
Well,
the Android, yeah.
I just threw in that link about you know, what's everybody's all, you know, feeling great about it right now, but what happens when the carriers get a hold of it? You know,
well, it's the same thing that happens with all the Android devices. They get a, you know, you get loaded with bloatware.
But
it will be available on Google Play at some point. We just don't know when that's going
to
be.
Yeah, yeah, at a cost yet to be determined, I guess. Yeah,
it'll probably be around $600.
Yeah, usually is.
Yep.
Well, I have to go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say that I have to make an admission. Uh-oh. And that was, I was sitting in a Best Buy mobile store 3 days ago and spent about an hour with a Nexus 7. And I almost walked out with a 32 gig Nexus 7. Except.
It's a nice screen.
It's a nice screen. It's a nice device. You know, it's reasonably priced and all of that. The only downside I just literally went out and purchased the new Bose QC20i headphones. They're noise canceling headphones, $300. And I got to tell you, they're the most amazing piece of technology I've ever owned, but it's iOS. You either have to buy the iOS or the Android one. So it's like, oh geez. But I've been thinking about just buying an Android device just to have it and live with it.
But you know me, you may never go back.
I know. Once you've begun Android, it's tough to go back. It's tough to get to the prison of iOS.
It's true. It's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Let me out.
Well, I really want to understand the malware problem on Android deeply.
Oh, it's a bunch of that's just fun. Yeah. That's all that is.
Okay. All right.
You're killing me, man. Any events coming up that we should probably highlight here, guys?
You know, I think we've highlighted them.
I think we've got them all. They're all available online at Minovate.com. So
absolutely.
Take a look at that.
Yeah.
So there you go. Well, that's not a bad week. That is a wrap. So we'll take another stab at it and see what else is going on in innovation and technology in Minnesota next week on
the Minovate Gang Podcast. Take care, boys.
See you guys. See ya.